clerk will call the docket.
Roxanne Morgan, Bank of America, successor by merger to BAC Home Loan Services, et al. Andrew W. McLaughlin, Drew D. Surratt, the accountant, James L. Winter, Chris L. Murphy, the accountant.
Mr. McLaughlin, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Henry McLaughlin. I represent the appellant Heresy in Wooten. I would request to reserve 4 minutes for the
process. 4 minutes, all right. Thank you.
When the appellee in this case filed its motion for judicial estoppel and summary judgment, if in the answer the memorandum in opposition to that, I had cited the fact that one of the cases cited by that in that motion provided that you cannot have judicial estoppel if it involves different parties. The circuit court might well have ruled otherwise, and if the circuit court could rule as it did in this case, the appellate brief would have been much shorter. And I think it is so that because I did not do that, I cannot argue on this appeal that the decision of the circuit court must be overruled solely on the basis that of the prior statements of this court that you cannot have judicial estoppel between different parties. However, I submit that we did save the point that the position taken by Ms. Wooten in this case was not inconsistent with the judicial decision that her counsel agreed to in the divorce. And it is not irrelevant to the fact that it's not inconsistent that there were different parties, because the there was nothing in the divorce decree that gave the bank the right to foreclose. There's nothing in the divorce decree that stated that the deed of trust was valid. There was nothing in the divorce decree that said that there were no defenses to the pending foreclosure that had been advertised. And the divorce decree did not require Ms. Wooten to submit to the language of the deed of trust. Did not say that. It didn't say that she had to submit to a foreclosure. It didn't say that she had, that it did say that both of the parties had to move to sell the house. It didn't give a deadline. It said must move to sell the house, including but not limited to a deed in lieu of foreclosure. Well, if it turns out that the sale of the house was through a deed in lieu of foreclosure, there would be negotiations on the question of the terms of that. A deed in lieu of foreclosure, if that is a means of selling the house.
Counsel, may I interrupt you for a moment? Is there any transcript of the hearing in which the trial court heard arguments and analyzed this case?
There was no court reporter. There was a narrative statement which was entered by the court, which was based on objections by the appellee, and that narrative statement says that the arguments of counsel were the same as set forth in the memorandum.
So the memorandum has a paragraph on the topic, is that right?
You mean the paragraph that I've cited in which we said it was not inconsistent?
Right.
There is that, Your Honor.
But there are no citations to legal authorities or any elaboration other than that one paragraph, am I right?
It did not cite a case law to that, but I submit that there's no rule that says that you have to cite case law if you cite correctly that in opposition to a motion, if you cite Brown.
There's no rule, but generally speaking, you have to advocate at a level of specificity that is effective. Otherwise, we end up in a position of having a lawyer for you.
Well, there was this statement that it was not inconsistent, and it there was also a in the briefs that were filed in the brief that was filed in opposition to the motions, it made the point that she did not sign the deed of trust, that it had self-serving things that were favorable to the lender. And it, in the objection to the divorce, to the order that was entered by the trial court in this case, it cited The memorandum in opposition to all of the motions.
Right. My only point is judicial estoppel is not the easiest concept. It's a little bit elastic, and as you've now found out with the privity idea, it has exceptions. And it, generally speaking, takes a little thoroughness to unpack it, even with people who are incredibly knowledgeable in the subject, which I'm not. So we rely upon you and counsel to inform us and educate us. Is that the whole of your education? Is that one paragraph?
Well, Your Honor, it was one paragraph, but it did go into some specificity. It said that the complaint does not seek a sale of the property or transfer the property to the bank. It seeks to impose a lien. There's no evidence before the court that Ms. Wooten failed to cooperate with selling the property or transfer it to the bank. Agreeing to cooperate in sale of real estate is not the same as consenting to a lien on real property, the terms of the deed of trust, and equitable subrogation. Now, that, I think, was somewhat specific in saying judicial estoppel should not apply. Judicial estoppel has to be something that is the same, that you say, this is what you did, and you agreed to, and what you're saying there is completely inconsistent with that, and I do submit that the memorandum is somewhat specific in saying that the divorce decree didn't do these things that the bank was attempting to ask the court to do in this case.
I'm not suggesting you didn't preserve the issue under 525. I'm just suggesting that the preservation is just very sparse.
Well, I can't argue that. I wish I'd done more, and in fact, one of the cases cited that was sent to the court by the bank specifically indicated language that would have precluded it. And as I started by saying, I didn't make that point, but I do submit that there is sufficient statement to the court that this is not a case of judicial estoppel, because you can't have judicial estoppel if it is not inconsistent. What the plea said, what the motion said as to judicial estoppel was that it was inconsistent, and he said it's not. And I submit that that is a matter of fact. And in fact, the whole concept of judicial estoppel has to do with inconsistencies in fact, not in arguments of law. And if there was the case made to the court that it was not an inconsistency, and I submit that there clearly is not.
In fact, counsel, the plea of estoppel and the motion for summary judgment filed by the bank in their paragraphs 8 and 9 laid it out much more clearly than your response did. So your response was sort of building on what they'd laid out, isn't it?
Well, they laid out...
the question, actually.
One of the things that went on with that motion was is that they set forth in detail the facts of the matter. And that is not in question and was not contested.
And they used the term judicial estoppel, even though you have not necessarily used it consistently throughout.
That is correct, however... I referred to the very motion in which they asked for.
That was my point. I was trying to get you to agree to.
And the fundamental issue is whether or not there is whether or not you're talking about a party who comes into court and says, I'm saying something that's inconsistent with a court order that I agreed to, and that is a question of fact. The case that was cited says it makes a difference whether you're talking about law or fact. Judicial estoppel has to do with the same facts, with something that is a matter of fact. And we did make the case that it was different, and it was different. Because it was different, this is not a case for judicial estoppel. The bank is seeking to obtain something that is different from what the divorce decree was. And they have other claims that they can make if this case is remanded. But at the bottom of this is an effort by the bank to impose on Ms. Wooten language that she didn't agree to. It is quite common in the world of deeds of trust, mortgages, and foreclosures, for borrowers to regret language in deeds of trust that they've signed, which are very favorable to banks. I pointed some of this out. There's language that says they can change the locks and things like that under certain circumstances. And the answer is always the same. You signed it, you're bound by it. What you understood, what you knew, is not the question. When you sign it, you're bound by it. But the same goes the other way. Banks want to impose deeds of trust that have all sorts of things in there that help the banks and are beneficial to them. They need to get the signature to do that. Now, banks take the position, correctly so, we're not going to loan the money unless we have these provisions. This is a condition to us loaning the money, but that doesn't apply to someone who they don't get the agreement for. And they didn't get this Rubin's agreement, and I submit that the divorce decree in this case did not adjudicate that she was liable for language in that deed of trust. It just wasn't there. And
may I ask you this? Did the concept of privity ever come up? I mean, in any hearing, any pleading, any brief, any anything?
The first I saw that I'm aware of that was in the appellee brief that says that the parties were in privity. I submit that's simply not so. I mean, there's no privity here between the bank and Ms. Wooten, or between the bank and Mr. Wooten. They were parties. Mr. Wooten and the bank were parties negotiating. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Christy Murphy. I'm here for and on behalf of Bank of America, successor by merger to BAC Home Loan Servicing, and Deborah Tomlin, the trustee. Your Honor, this case is about two separate and distinct but somewhat related issues. The first issue, Mr. McLaughlin touched on and I'll discuss, is it's great concern when the trial court does not have the opportunity to hear fully the positions and the arguments of the parties.
Counsel, can I ask you this? Your side of the case in the trial court did brief collateral estoppel.
We did. A judicial estoppel, Your Honor.
Judicial estoppel. Did the concept of privity not come up in any of the research or the writings that you presented to the court?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, I can't answer that question for you only because my entrance to this case came at the appellate level.
But you would concede, do you have a position in terms of what the law says about the role of privity in judicial estoppel?
Do, Your Honor.
And what
in
is
fact, the position that this court has adopted throughout the jurisprudence of the Commonwealth is that it's similar to the requirement of res judicata, although they're different concepts. It's that the litigation must be between the same parties. Now, however, like in res judicata, there is plenty of case law from the court that states that if the parties are in privity or...
Well, debtors and lenders are generally not in privity. They're generally antagonistic.
That's true, Your Honor. In fact, this court looks at when determining whether privity exists, and of course, this privity is different from the regular horizontal vertical privity you see in like a real estate easement or declaration case. This privity is a little different. And what this court in its jurisprudence has said is that you look at the relationship between the parties. Now, the relationship between the bank and Mr. Wooten and the bank and Mrs. Wooten are admittedly different. However, I think if you look at the relationships, it still can lead to a privity relationship with either or both. Now, I don't think a privity relationship is required between the bank and both Mr. and Mrs. Wooten. I think a privity relationship is required between one, the bank, and one of them, because all three are parties to this current action. And
how could my creditor be in privity with me? My creditor wants to take his loan back from me. How can a debtor and a creditor be in privity for purposes of res judicata, collateral estoppel, or judicial estoppel?
Your Honor, this court in Raley versus Hayter, a little bit of an older case, gave some examples of when privity can exist. And that
between a creditor and a debtor?
Didn't say creditor and debtor, but it does say in situations of co-ownership of property. If you look at the terms of the deed of trust, what Mr. Wooten did was he conveyed the property to the bank pending payment of the amount to due under the note. That deed of trust secures the bank's interest in that property. And so in essence, the bank, until that loan is paid in full and the deed of trust released from the record title to the property, is a co-owner of the property with Mr. Wooten. So The Raley case at least suggests that that creates a privity relationship due to co-ownership. Now, again, you look, what this court has said many times in jurisprudence is that you look at the closeness of the relationship between the parties. And that relationship exists in such a way here that it gives, as Mr. McLaughlin said, many obligations of both parties pursuant to the plain language of the deed of trust. That creates the type of closeness that can create, and in this situation does create, privity relationship between Bank of America and Mr. Wooten. And I think we can go so far as to say that it creates a similar relationship between the bank and Mrs. Wooten. While she didn't execute the documents, she did after Mr. Wooten executed the deed of trust.
Of course, the problem is, apparently, from what we know of the record, the trial judge was never informed of this concept or told that is an axiomatic part of Virginia law that privity must exist.
That is true, Your Honor, that at least to my knowledge, and what I have, my knowledge of this case, unfortunately, is what Your Honors have, is it's just the record as it appears currently. Mr. Papil filed the motion, argued the case. He's now Judge Papil, so of course he can't be here before Your Honors. And so I wish I had an answer to say to you, this is why it wasn't done, or this is how it was done. I don't, and I'm sorry for that. The best I can do now is explain the position I think that we should have taken and we would have taken had the issue come up. I will say in the VEPCO case, which was cited by us both in our brief at the trial court and in the multiple briefs we filed in this court, it does address the issue, but to my knowledge, it was never argued before the trial court, raised before the trial court, or brought to the trial court's attention. But I do think, and I'm going to go back to where I started, that's a cause for great concern in this case. It's not just the privity issue. It's the issue of, is it a matter of fact or is it a matter of law? It's the privity issue. It's the issue of whether there was an inconsistent position pertaining to some of the other factors, one of which I'm going to get to in just a moment. None of these issues were raised by Ms. Wooten, developed, argued, or any citations to any case law provided to the trial court. So when the judge left the bench, took the file, reviewed it, he had before him the arguments that were given to him. And I think on our side, we gave the case law, we cited Bentley funding, and we said, here's the test the Virginia Supreme Court's given us. Here are the three, maybe four factors that you have to look at.
But of course, the test requires privity, and the burden of going forward was on the bank, and the court was not informed of the critical part of the test upon which trial court probably would have considered it further.
And Your Honor, we can't know how the court addressed the privy issue specifically when when the judge was in chambers. But the best I can tell you is that the position we would have taken and the position I think we just assumed to be the case was that the bank was in a privity relationship with both Mr. and Mrs. Wooten. And again, unfortunately, we don't have the record to develop that actual argument or that actual position. So again, the best I can do now is tell Your Honors is that's the position the bank would have taken. Had I been there at the time, it's probably the most likely and certainly the position I would have taken, because I think the jurisprudence of this court allows that argument. I think it allows the development of that legal position and allows that argument to be made. And I think, again, that conclusion is that it leads to a privity relationship. So, while we don't have same parties, which is what the language of the case law states, like in a res judicata context, which the Raley was a res judicata context, which cites to, I think, one of the first cases, the Nero versus Ferris case this court decided, really sort of developed the idea of course, in a res judicata context, and those are different legal principles, judicial estoppel, res judicata, but that if the court requires same parties in order for the plea to be sustained, if they are in privity with the parties to the prior litigation, then that satisfies that requirement. And I think that that position is the one that should be adopted here if the court does consider the privity issue before it. Again, I think Mr. McLaughlin stipulates that he didn't argue the privity issue. It was not raised for the trial court. And under the Strauss case, cited in our briefing, this court has stated that it is an appellate court and it can't review what the trial court did in affirm or reverse, in whole or in part, based on arguments that simply weren't raised to the trial court. The judge, again, went to his chambers, he reviewed what he had before him, and none of these arguments were before him, and he made a ruling. And it's that ruling that's before Your Honors today. Second, and the second issue here, is that Mr. McLaughlin does, in the one paragraph in the opposition to the plea of estoppel, he does argue that she did not take an inconsistent position. Now, one issue I do want to raise before your honors is the standard of review in this case. We seem to have a disagreement on what the standard of review is, and I can see the cause for confusion. The standard of review of the Bentley funding case for a review of a granting of a plea of a judicial estoppel is abuse of discretion. Ms. Wooten suggests to the court that it's a de novo standard. Now, it might be because it was in the context what the plea was called was plea of judicial estoppel and motion for summary judgment. Now, when you grant a motion for summary judgment, of course, jurisprudence guides that is a de novo standard. However, in a judicial estoppel context, the court reviews it, at least under Bentley funding, reviews it for abuse of discretion. I think in this context, what's under appeal is the court's granting of the plea of judicial estoppel, and I think that, therefore, your honors have to review this for an abuse of discretion. Of course, they're very different standards, and standard review is going to be important here, and so I will ask that your honors adopt, like in Bentley funding, the abuse of discretion standard.
Counsel, am I right in this? The trial court predicated the judicial estoppel holding entirely on the divorce decree, not anything else. Am I right?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Only because...
Well, what else is?
It's the brief that we filed, the brief...
What's the predicate for the prior inconsistent statement?
Sorry. Yes, Your Honor. It is the final divorce decree. That's
so
correct.
The divorce decree says that a transcript of an April 25 hearing was incorporated by reference that there was a telephone conference. There was evidence, there was arguments of counsel, and there appears to be statements made by the court, but that incorporated by reference material was never before the trial court, just the order, the several-page order?
As far as I'm aware, that's correct, Your Honor. April 25th, 2012 transcript. In fact, I still to this date haven't seen that actual transcript.
Well, even under an abuse of discretion standard, isn't that an incredibly thin platform to build a judicial estoppel argument?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because what Ms. Wooten argues in this case, in fact, this is, I'm quoting right from her brief, when she says that her agreement to cooperate in the sale of property does not mean she agreed to be subject to a lien. Now, generally speaking, I completely agree with that statement. I don't think that statement's false at all. But it's not what happened in this case. In fact, if we look, and I'm at the appendix of page 69, which is the final divorce decree, if we look at paragraph 2, which is on page 3 of 4, this is the paragraph which contains the statements that we contend create the judicial estoppel issue, and I'm looking right at the end, it does require them, both Mr. and Mrs. Wooten, to cooperate to turn the marital residence over to the bank by deed in lieu of foreclosure.
Well, that's the court's position. That's not the party's position. That's the court ordering something.
It's a position that Mrs. Wooten adopted and agreed with.
How?
Where?
Through her counsel, Your Honor. Because
where?
When they signed the order.
Seen.
Yes.
You saw it.
It's a position that she didn't in any way raise any objection to, take any issue with, or...
Well, that's different. We've all signed orders that we disagreed with, but we figured the case is over, let's be done with it. That doesn't mean we're agreeing with it, much less advocating it, which is advocacy and assertions of a position is usually the predicate for judicial estoppel, right? Not acquiescence.
Sure. No, I agree with Your Honor. It's normally it is a higher burden of actually adopting or actually taking the position.
Justice Smith's question is, where do we see something more than acquiescence in this case?
Well, the court just can speak through its orders, and that's what we have before us.
But you are asking us to conclude that she took an inconsistent position. The only evidence that you can cite that she took an inconsistent position is on page 70 of the joint appendix where her counsel signed it seen. And if we cannot conclude that seen equals an inconsistent position, then we would have to find that there's an abuse of discretion, would we not? Even using the standard that you advocate.
No, Your Honor.
Okay, well then where is the, where, what other evidence is there of an inconsistent position other than the endorsement of the order?
I agree with Your Honor in the answer to your question in a limited context that that is correct. Your Honor is correct. If Your Honor were to find, or Your Honors were to find, that she did not adopt and take that position, then there is no inconsistent position. However, that, and again, I know I'm going to sound like a broken record, that issue was never raised before the trial court. Judge Ruckel never had the opportunity to consider that argument because it was never brought before him. We took the position that she adopted the position. That's the position she took, and she made an inconsistent statement. And nobody ever disagreed with that. And again, as this court has stated in Strauss, this court is an appellate court, and its position is to review the what was presented to the trial court and make a decision. Is it right or wrong? I don't know. I'm not comfortable telling you one way or the other, to be honest with you. But what I can tell you is that the judge had what he had, the arguments that were given to him. Mrs. Wooten had, well, this case was pending for years. She had, and the plea itself was pending for a while before the act. They had filed their opposition, which they could have put anything in their opposition. They could have argued anything they wanted to, cited any case law, developed the argument.
Even if we assume you're correct and agree with your position, the only thing in this paragraph that you're citing says the parties shall cooperate with any and all efforts to sell marital residence, including but not limited to any efforts to turn the marital residence over to the bank and leave foreclosure. And you say that should be read to include all the terms of the deed of trust.
No, Your Honor, not at all. In fact, I think Mrs. Wooten's incorrect in that position. If you look at the final order entered by the trial court in this matter, it only does one thing with respect to Ms. Wooten's interest. May I finish responding to your question? My time is up.
Sure, go right ahead.
Okay. We are not asking that she be bound by the terms of the deed of trust, not at all. But the final order states is very simple, as pertains to her interest, is that it creates a lien on her interest. It doesn't bind her by the terms of the deed of trust. It doesn't bind her, you know, for, I think the example Mr. McLaughlin gave was they were allowed to enter or change the locks. There are several things the letter can do. We didn't ask for any of that. The final order doesn't provide for any of that. It just provides that the bank has a lien on the entire interest rather than just on Mr.
That's not here either, though. That's not in the, that particular provision is not in the order, though, is it?
It is, Your Honor, because what it says is, and what we contend Ms. Wooten agreed to do, was without reserving an unencumbered one-half portion of the property, without reserving any interest in the property whatsoever, she agreed to turn the property over to satisfy the lien. In fact, she went beyond that. She agreed to turn the property over to satisfy the lien, and she'd pay one-half of any deficit that was created. Their only conclusion we can draw from that is that she agreed that her interest in the property was subject to the lien. So we'd ask you to affirm the trial court. Thank you.
Counsel, I have one additional question. The real reason we're here is because Countrywide's settlement agent, for some inexplicable reason, waited more than 3 weeks to record a deed of trust that had been executed by Mr. Wooten 3 weeks earlier. Does that bear any relevance to our decision?
In the case at this stage, it does not, Your Honor. Your Honor is correct about that fact, but I don't think it bears any, it has any issue with this particular matter. It may, and if Your Honor's remand, we may see you again one day, and it very well may then. It just doesn't at this point.
All right, move on.
May it please the court, I think I understood counsel for the bank to say that they're not taking the position that Ms. Wooten, by reason of the circuit court's order, is subject to all the terms of the deed of trust. But I submit that the order itself, if not reversed, would in fact subject her to all the terms of the deed of trust. It says in this order that that deed of trust is a valid lien against her interest. And the deed of trust has many specifics in there which allow the bank, for example, to foreclose, to charge against the interest of the property, the cost of foreclosure. It specifies what sort of advertisement is required, and it somewhat shortens it from the fallback position of the statute. And it has provisions in there under this lien as to what the bank can do to protect its interest in the lien which include under certain circumstances changing the locks.
I apologize for interrupting again. Your arguments, at least to me, make a lot of sense. And the privity argument, which you waived, is darn near dispositive to me. But I'm still focused on this one paragraph, and there's only one sentence in the paragraph that summarizes what your position was in the trial court. Tell me if this is exaggerated, but for you to win, we would have to add a lot to that one sentence in terms of legal analysis, in terms of the conceptual boundaries of the doctrine. I mean, it would be taking a thread and making a robe out of it. Is that what we should do in this case? I mean, have you presented enough to the trial court, and frankly to us, to authorize us to use the powers that we have?
Well, I submit that we did, Your Honor. And it says in this, it's more than one sentence, it's a paragraph, it says that her position is not inconsistent with the divorce proceedings. It says what the divorce decree said to do, and that is not inconsistent with her position, that she's not subject to the lien of the bank. It says agreeing to cooperate in the sale of real property is not the same as consenting to a lien on real property. The terms of the deed of trust and equitable subrogation.
Yeah, that's your sentence. That's the one sentence that addresses the legal issue that the court is being asked to issue a full opinion on.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yeah, I would say that is pretty significant that they're attempting to impose all the terms of this deed of trust based on a divorce decree that did not, in fact, do that. I'm not saying and have not argued that their case must fail because they didn't present an argument of privity. I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying if, in fact, there were privity, then the court, this court, can uphold the circuit court based on any grounds the circuit court could properly have come to the conclusion it did. But there was no privity. And as Your Honor said in the question of opposing counsel, there's no privity between a creditor and a borrower.
But you're the appellant.
Yes.
It's your obligation to have raised it below. Now, they may have had obligations in terms of presenting a full presentation to a trial court when it's their motion, and they've obviously briefed it.
What I'm saying,
but you're the appellant. You have to raise the contest below if you want us to rule in your favor and reverse the trial court.
I see my time has expired. May I?
Absolutely.
We did not raise the contention that it was different parties, and therefore I agree that we don't have that issue here. What we did raise is it's inconsistent, and I submit that it was in fact inconsistent.
Thank you, Mr. McLaughlin. Call the next case.